This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Ready for an awesome episode? Well, so are we. But you know what? Before we get to it, I got to tell you that members of Navy Federal Credit Union could earn more and save more. Bam! Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as our friends at Navy Federal do. Start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit. For example, you could open an Easy Start certificate for just $50. And then how many certificates do this? You can then add money at any time and watch your savings grow. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
Hey, this is Joe Crane, host of Veteran on the Move podcast. And when I'm not helping veterans transition to entrepreneurship, I'm stacking Benjamins.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and how about sun, beaches, and a drink with an umbrella? Sound good? Well, today, we're talking about retiring outside the USA. So if you want a retirement happy ending, we've got you covered. Some experts join us. So first, his new book is called The Fun Side of the Wall and covers why baby boomers retire in droves to Mexico. Say hello to Travis Luther. And a woman who's originally from France and lived in Guatemala, from the blog Reach Financial Independence, it's Pauline Paquin. And rounding out our panel, he retired from corporate life at 43 and moved to Panama with his wife and daughter. He's the guy behind the popular Route to Retire blog. Say hello to Jim White. Plus, worried about your kids not understanding money? On today's Friday FinTech segment, we'll share a solution called Jaspi and learn about it from founder Benny Nachman. Later, we'll magnify Jake's money. He's a high school business teacher and wants to gift his students some stock. What's the easiest way to do this? And of course, I'll keep you coming back for more with my trivia. And now, a guy who tried to retire to another country, but they just shipped him right back to the U.S. of A., it's Joe Salcihi.
Entirely not true, but if I could have retired to Bavaria, I totally would have. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Retire Abroad for the Win podcast. I'm Joe Salcihi, Average Show Money on Twitter. And we have a very special panel for you today. As you heard Doug say earlier, no Len, no Paula, no OG. Instead, we've got a whole different cast of characters. So let's introduce them to you. We're going to start off in, I believe, in San Diego, where she's hanging out at a Marine base. Our friend Paula Paquin from Reach Financial Independence is back. How are you? Did I lose you? And she's gone.
Hi, I'm not. Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for having me. How are you doing?
Good, but you're on a Marine. Are you keeping the Marines in line, Pauline? Is that what's going on?
I am actually giving them financial advice.
Nice.
And I am volunteering at a relief society. So we do budget counseling and help them transition to civilian life and stuff like that. And yeah, that's been very interesting.
That's fabulous. Tell us about why you decided to go to Guatemala.
It's just kind of happened. I left France right after business school, and I just wanted to travel the world. Ended up in about 30 countries and got a job offer in Guatemala to stay a little bit longer in a nice hotel. I said, sure, why not? Let's do that. Let's see a little more of the world for a little bit longer. It happened to be a decent salary and a decent working conditions. So not your typical, oh, I'm just going to backpack and bartend on the way and hope to make it to the next town kind of job. So I then ended up in a law firm in Guatemala City and spent about 3 years there total. And eventually came back to start a little guest house and have my own business there.
And that's when the blog was created, I think, right?
Yes. I was doing a bit of travel blogging and kind of got burnt out talking about my travels and interrupting my travels to take a picture for the blog or jot down something for the blog. I just wanted to see the world on my own terms and thought, hey, let's talk money and how money buys freedom and choices and how all the people who may not have that dream of going around the world like crazies, but just, you know, staying at home with their kids or going back to college or taking a lower paying job they love, how could they do that? And how could they achieve their financial goals?
Some of the barriers you ran into when you were there, I loved reading about at the time. I really felt for you sometimes, Pauline, some of the things, and we'll talk about those later. But I'm so glad you could be with us today to talk a little bit about going elsewhere. Also, a gentleman who I believe started off researching this stuff. He's in Denver and talks in his hot new book, The Fun Side of the Wall, about baby boomers retiring in Mexico. Travis Luther's here. How are you, man?
I'm awesome, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. But how did this project start where you decided to look at the fun side of the wall, as you call it?
Well, I will admit it was a total accident. I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. And in 2008, I was in graduate school for sociology at the University of Colorado, Denver. And I had picked up Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek, which had just come out. And I had read that. And then at an airport, I read Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat. And I had kind of this epiphany that, you know, I had grown up in rural Washington on the border of Washington State and Idaho. And I hadn't really thought much of the world outside of the United States. In fact, as I say in my book, kind of naively thought the world outside the United States was dangerous, dumb, and stupid, as I said. And, you know, having read these books and being an entrepreneur myself, I thought, gosh, maybe I've been kind of naive. So using those books and the websites that were in there, I started to reach out to entrepreneurs who were in India and Panama and Costa Rica. And I came to discover what we call now digital nomads, you know, entrepreneurs who are also from the United States, who are traveling around the world and taking advantage of the cost savings to run their businesses from other places. So this kind of coincided with my having to make a decision about what my thesis was going to be on. And so I went to my advisor and I said, I think I've got something I'm really interested in. I want to study expats who have left the United States. And I want to come to understand, why would anybody leave what I had come to believe was the greatest country in the world? She said, you'll never get out of graduate school. If you survey every expat who's ever left the United States, you've really got to narrow it down to a specific place, to a specific demographic. And so I came across an enclave of expats in Mexico and realized that most of those, in fact, were baby boomers. And so, you know, again, just kind of happy accident, I narrowed down my focus and then dug into the research and really had no idea that it would end up, you know, being a 10-year project and result in a book and everything that's come since. But that's basically the evolution of my story and my discovery of these enclaves in Mexico.
It kind of looks like this whole discussion, Travis, didn't take you where you thought it was going to take you, though.
No, you know, I mean, you know, anyone who's gone to graduate school knows you got to form a hypothesis. And mine was basically that, you know, people who could not afford to live in the United States, or I'm sorry, people who could not afford to retire in the United States would choose Mexico because they had no other option and because they had no money. And I actually found quite the opposite of that to be true. The people that chose to move to Mexico were actually some of the more affluent baby boomers in the United States, as well as some of the most educated.
I want to ask you one more question. Just in the description of your book, there's a line that grabbed me when I first saw the book. And so I opened it up before we got on the call today because I couldn't remember the exact words. And it is, your book is a critique of the way retirement's been commodified in the United States. And I remember that hit me like a ton of bricks at the time. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is, for most of us, we see retirement as a place where we exit work and then we go into some kind of structured living that's largely dictated by these corporations or these retirement centers, where there's these really rigid schedules and there's this kind of limited scope of opportunities. And you kind of live in this Soviet style block living where everything's kind of the same and every 54 people share a treadmill and a pool. And the people that had chose to go to Mexico really wanted to have more freedom to dictate the terms of their retirement. And what they were especially concerned with is having support, but also preserving their autonomy. So they wanted to live in a place where they had these relationships of reciprocity, as I call them, where they could help others out and be helped out to an equal extent while still having the freedom to do what they wanted to do with their retirement. And for a lot of them, that meant continuing on education projects or doing community service projects, you know, that weren't dictated by anyone but themselves, entering social clubs and activities. And again, like I said, largely living on their own, though, in a community that was still supportive.
Yeah, it's fascinating because not at all what you think about when you think about people retiring to Mexico. In fact, exactly the opposite. And a guy who is doing the opposite of what a lot of people do at age 43, he decides he's going to go to Panama with his wife and daughter from route to retire. Jim White's finally on the show. It's about time we got you here, my friend.
I appreciate you having me, Joe.
Well, tell everybody, you're not 43 yet. You're maybe 41 or 42, let's say, and you're thinking about moving. When did Panama enter the discussion?
When my daughter was born in 2010, that was kind of the big eye-opener for me. When I had to go back to work and couldn't be with her every day, I was like, well, wait a minute, this isn't right. I want to be spending my time with her. So it was at that point I started looking for some options. And then I ended up coming across the FIRE movement. I came across Joe Udo's blog, Retire by 40. That kind of got me on track to go, hey, there's other options. This guy, he's just like me. I mean, this is a possibility to actually retire early and not be Elon Musk or a baller like that. And so that was the...
You're still a baller though, Jim. You're still a baller though, my friend.
not as much as you, Joe.
Nice. But it's funny. So that would make your daughter 10 or 11 now. And, you know, most people, and I'm sure in Travis's work, he's looked at this too. I would imagine people wait till kid's 18 to do anything, right? Got to get the kid out of the house first, Jim. Then we can go. Why did you decide to go then, right at 43?
I'm too much of a softy. I wanted to spend as much time as I could with her. So, yeah, so I looked at trying to find a way that I could leave work early and just be able to spend the time with her. So that's when financial independence became the way to do it. And it wasn't about having more money than I could possibly spend. It was about having enough money that we could live our normal lifestyle without needing to worry about working again. It's not to say we'll never work again, but it's buying us the time that we don't have to if we don't need to, if we don't want to.
Well, I'm so excited you're here with us. We got Jim here. We've got Travis here. We've got Pauline here. We're going to talk about retiring abroad, the good, the bad, the ugly. So let's roll into our discussion of retiring abroad. Different than most of our roundtables where we focus on a major media piece, this time I just want to pick all three of your brains about the why, the how. Travis, from your research, and then Pauline and Jim from your personal experiences. And I think, Jim, because you went last in our introductions, I'm going to go to you first. What was attractive specifically about Panama, and why Panama versus other countries? Like Travis, you know, looked at Mexico. Pauline was in Guatemala. Did you look at all these things? And I'm imagining a nerdy spreadsheet, or did you just say Panama or bust?
No, I'm definitely a research guy and a spreadsheet guy, but there were no spreadsheets for this until later. But it actually started out where we were looking at just finding a place where our net worth would last a little bit longer. So that initially started in the U.S., looking for a lower cost of living place in the U.S. Then I said, well, wait a minute, we're going to be retired. Why don't we look at other options? Why not look at different countries? And so I started digging around into different countries. And there's obviously going to be pros and cons to wherever you go in the world. For us, though, We needed kind of a smaller step than some people would be more comfortable with. And overall, Panama became that answer because, you know, they use the U.S. dollar here. You know, the expat communities, they speak English. They, you know, they have good health care. They have everything lined up. It's close to close enough to home compared to, you know, maybe Thailand or something like that. And so this just seemed to be a place that matched what we were looking for.
So to some degree, it sounds like there was also this ease because you didn't have to calculate currency. You didn't have to negotiate a different language.
Right. When we go to the ATM, it spits out $20 bills, and I'm pretty happy about that. We're stacking Benjamins at the ATMs.
Nice. But, 20 at a time.
It's definitely much easier. And that's not to say there aren't a lot of differences. I mean, obviously the Panamanians here are speaking Spanish and we're learning that and everything, but it's still an easier step than a lot of places would be.
Pauline, you explained earlier that you were organically in Guatemala for a job before going off on your own. Did you ever consider, though, other countries, or was it going to be Guatemala because you were already there?
I did. I actually, Guatemala, so after that round the world trip, was the first country I landed a job in. But I applied for things in Mexico, in Argentina, thinking, you know, big countries, big population, there's got to be a job for me there. Sadly, big country also means bigger regulations, and it was way more complicated. And Guatemala was, oh, you can start working on a tourist visa legally if the company sponsors you. You know, from day one, you're still on your tourist visa, but you're good to go to work. Get your salary, and then in 6 months' time, you get your residency. One thing I did not want to do is work under the table or, you know, do anything that would go against the country that was receiving me. So that worked out. And after a couple of years, I thought, oh, it would be nice to be a little bit closer to family. So I moved to Barcelona and I started a business there, which as a European with a Schengen passport was super easy to do. So I didn't have to ask anyone permission to do that. I miserably failed during the 2008 financial crisis. So the business went down. And I moved on to the UK thinking bigger salaries in the UK. I can tolerate the weather for a little while and fill back the coffers. So I moved there. And once the coffers were full, I moved to Morocco thinking like you guys, you know, similar time zone, Panama, Mexico, that's easy, that's close to home. Morocco, they speak French. It's very familiar. And that would be perfect. Except I was living in a very expat bubble and I did not want that. I wanted to live a local life.
Why not live in an expat bubble?
Because I simply didn't see the point. Why am I going to be in another country? Like in Morocco, I would get together with French friends to drink wine and eat ham because it's forbidden by the Muslim religion. So you cannot go out to a restaurant and do that. And every time someone would fly back to France, they would come back with that, you know, liquid gold and we would all sip it like, oh my God, we miss France so much. And that's not the goal. You're not in another country to live like you would back home. So that started to bother me, but they were my social circle and my Arabic was not good enough to just go have a conversation like we're having with my English. So I could not really hang with the Moroccans. I didn't really like hanging with the French. And in Guatemala, I was speaking Spanish and getting along with locals and having local friends.
Did you have...
And also, local friends don't leave. Because when you're an expat, you go to goodbye parties all the time.
Right. Somebody else going. Did you have trouble speaking Spanish at all? Or is your Spanish good enough that it was fairly easy?
Yeah, it's like my English, if not better. So I didn't have any trouble. And that was the ease of acclimating to after living in Guatemala, moving to Spain. I'm perfectly happy and confident having conversations that go further than just taking a cab or ordering something in a restaurant.
Some of these things that Pauline and Jim are saying, Travis, these resonate with your research about why people go to Mexico?
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing that I was surprised about is how many people arrived in Mexico sight unseen. So, you know, while there is a lot of other countries that they're looking at, you know, Panama, certainly one of them, Costa Rica, Belize, most of the people that chose Mexico, that was their first and only choice. And most of them had not even made a visit there before they decided to move. Which, you know, actually having started my original research in 2008 and published the book at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, I've kind of got this 10 years of data to look at. And so 10 years ago, that wasn't so much the case. Most people had a friend or a family member who had retired down there. They had gone down and had a visit, figured out if they liked it or not, and then decided to return. I think as with the advent of the, not the advent necessarily, but the improvements of the internet and the ability to do video conferences and more websites and more content, a lot more people felt more comfortable arriving in Mexico just based on the research that they had done online. You know, with regard to why they ended up choosing Mexico, I mean, one, definitely the proximity to the United States, you know, makes it really easy. And as Jim was saying, you know, for people who are trying to kind of put a toe in the international, you know, moving experience, you know, outside of Canada, you can't get much closer to Mexico. And then I think of the people who did do a little more exploration, you know, I can't say this from a data perspective, just from talking to people, but, you know, Belize was another popular place that they looked at, and they just felt like that didn't really have the infrastructure that they wanted. You know, it was a lot more rural and a lot more bumpy roads than they were up for. You know, Costa Rica, the general consensus was that that had kind of gotten too expensive and priced a lot of people out of what they, at least what they wanted for comparable living. And I think Panama is kind of a similar thing too. You know, the kinds of places that they wanted to live in were still more expensive than the places that they had found in Mexico.
Did you find that people arrived in Mexico with a pretty good grasp of what their budget would be? Because one thing I find in Guatemala, yeah, sure, you can eat rice and beans and live in a shack for $300 a month. But a lot of people arrive there and say, oh, my God, what? You want $1,000 for a beautiful, furnished 2-bedroom, that's crazy. I can live in insert bad suburbs of the US or very remote location for the same price. And sure you can, but you would not live in the best neighborhood of town, et cetera, et cetera. So I think at least in my case, I've seen a lot of people get surprised about that and how Western amenities come usually with a pretty steep price.
You can do a lot of living before we have Travis answer that. You can do a lot of living in Texarkana, Pauline, for $1,000. Just saying. Here.
But I'm in San Diego, so I don't know what money buys anymore. It's crazy.
Travis, people surprise? People get some sticker shock?
No, I mean, like even in some of Mexico's most expensive places, they're still 20%, you know, less expensive than the median cost of living here, right? So like, I've got another book coming out that really just kind of digs into expat communities in general and kind of looks at the financial stuff. And I use Denver as the average cost of living, because Denver kind of represented, not just because I live here, but it ended up kind of representing the average cost of living, you know. And there's really nice neighborhoods in Mexico City that are comparable to that. But what you're not seeing, and why people love Mexico so much, is because you're not seeing that rent also comes with, you know, a gardener and a pool in your house, and it comes with medical care that's only 20% of the cost of medical care in the United States. So even if you end up living in one of those really expensive communities, if you do your residency right, you still have this other cost savings that makes it well worth it.
Jim?
To your point, Travis, I mean, when we came here to Boquete, Panama, we're in the mountains here, but it's a big expat community, and you probably already know that, but we expected the cost to be a lot less than it actually is. And that's not to say that it's not less expensive than probably Denver or whatever. I mean, we're paying, we have a beautiful place that we're living in, a condo, and it's $1,100 a month for a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, fully furnished. And it comes with a bunch of amenities like access to a full gym and all that kind of stuff. And that's certainly cheaper. And I'm sure if we didn't live right in this expat area, like Pauline was talking about, if we kind of blended in a little bit more with the Panamanian lifestyles, we could probably get much cheaper prices and everything. But in general, the expats have driven up the prices here probably over the last decade or two, where it is a little more costly than a lot of people expect, especially if they're doing like we were talking about, going sight unseen, showing up. People do that and then their mind's just blown, like, whoa, wait a minute, I was not expecting this at all.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Like, the expats drive up the prices in certain neighborhoods, but I've also found that you can walk three blocks and save 80% right. over what you purchased for dinner three blocks into where the expats are. So I think the braver you are, the more you can expect to save. That's what I'll say. You know, the more up for an adventure you are, the better you're going to do.
So true.
If you want to go to Puerto Vallarta and live right on the beach in a condo full of other Americans and Canadians, you're going to pay some pretty comparable pricing to coastal towns in the United States. If you're willing to get 5 or 10 blocks off of the beach in Puerto Vallarta, you're going to have a totally different, more authentic, and definitely more affordable experience.
Travis, I'm glad you brought up bravery, because that brings up my next question, which is the reason a lot of people don't move abroad is because of fear. There are things that they fear. Jim, I'll go back to you. Were there things that you were afraid of when you moved to Panama that you thought, wow, there's no reason I should have been afraid of this at all?
I don't think there was much. I think the biggest concern that we had was the language difference. We thought not being fluent in Spanish was going to be just a really tough hurdle to get past. But we learned once we got here that as long as you're trying, then there's that appreciation that the Panamanians have, and they'll go out of their way to do their darndest to help you. And I'm not saying it's not worth learning the language. I mean, that's a huge help, and we're studying and practicing every single day, but it's not something we really needed to worry about as much as we thought we would.
Pauline, when you moved out to that beautiful lake, and man, you had some people giving you hell when you were trying to build that, the community. I remember all the real estate you were working on building. Did you anticipate the problem with authorities that you kind of got? And was there anything that you were kind of afraid of that ended up not being a big deal?
So I built a little guest house, and then I built my own residence and went through all the red tape you could possibly imagine. And it does not apply to locals. And locals had just that way of going through their cousin who likes the mayor, or putting a little bribe here and there. And
yeah, because you were trying to develop several pieces of land, right? Weren't you subdividing a piece of land at one point?
Yeah, it was 90 acres in total that I was trying to split into 100 plots to make 100 plots for people who wanted to move there and make a little community. And it was hell, but nothing to be afraid of. I got concerned a little bit because of the geographical position. It's in the jungle next to the border with Mexico. And if you look at all the drugs maps, that is where it comes from, the south, and goes to the north. But in 8 years, I haven't seen anything. I don't even lock my house most of the time. It stays open when I have guests. I'm like, you guys just let yourselves in and I'll see you tomorrow morning. So it's been really great. I'm always concerned, like I was mentioning, immigration previously. And right now that I moved to the US and I'm waiting for a green card, I have a work permit, but, you know, always try to do things right. And sometimes some countries make it a little more complicated. Like this year, I was trying to pay my property taxes in Guatemala, and they said, well, you need to bring the proof that you paid last year. I'm like, you guys have the records? Oh, no, we don't, because the guy who charged you last year, he doesn't work there anymore because he kept the money. So I had to prove that I did pay in order not to be charged for last year. They just wanted to know, hey, did you not pay or did the guy steal your money? Like, and it's fun more than anything. No big scares.
I love how you can end that with, that's fun. Travis, back to Mexico. I last just before COVID went to Cabo, and I remember, which is so Mexican, by the way, just kidding. and I get off the plane there. And of course, the first thing somebody tells me about are the gangs, right? And about these people that got murdered. And you think, oh my goodness, this is a lawless place. And much of that unfounded.
Well, you know, I always say that Mexico is a dangerous place for certain people. And fortunately, it's not dangerous at all for expats. Unfortunately, it is very dangerous for people who are in or near the drug trade or who are politicians or police officers in the states that have heavy drug presence. But that violence rarely spills over to the expat community. And as I kind of often say, it's kind of like the shark attack phenomenon, right? We hear about every single shark attack that happens because they're actually so rare. And that's the same thing with violence against expats in Mexico. We hear about it every single time it happens because it is so extraordinarily rare. So should people be on the lookout? Yeah, of course. But the chances of them being shot and killed are actually greater in Detroit, in Washington, D.C., in New Orleans than they are in any of the cities or communities in Mexico.
Mexico loves their tourism dollars way too much to allow for any of that. And they've doubled down on security and measures to encourage more tourism and bring more dollars.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just this is my own opinion, but I think a lot of those drugs end up in the United States, and I don't think it'd be very good for business if U.S. and Canadian citizens ended up being the target of drug violence.
Jim, what about in Panama?
Safety is like that was one of our big concerns moving here, and that is not a big deal here. I mean, just like Travis was saying, I mean, there's plenty of cities in the U.S. where you'd have to be a lot more careful than you would here. I know when we first moved here, obviously anywhere you go, you always want to be looking over your shoulder a little bit. You want to be smart. But when we first moved here, we were very cautious just because we're in a different country. We don't know anything about this. So even walking back home, we weren't staying out at night. And then eventually that changed. And when we'd be walking home in the evenings, maybe from a restaurant or something like that, there was no fear. There were no worries. There were no concerns. It wasn't like we felt, oh my gosh, there could be somebody around the corner here that wants to jump you or something. There's not. And even in most of Panama, guns are not a common thing. It's not, I mean, it's pretty hard to get a gun here in general, but you're just not going to find a lot of that anyway. So you don't find a lot of violence or much here. It's usually more petty theft, I'd say, than anything, and not anything extraordinary either.
I want to wrap up this discussion, but I have two questions. And the next one, I'd like you guys to just give me a fairly quick answer. The state of healthcare, because if somebody's going to move to where you are or where you've been or where you've studied, they're obviously going to do a deeper dive there. But Jim, healthcare in Panama, good, bad, or ugly?
Very good. Even if we move back, now that I understand medical tourism is actually a real thing, it's not as scary as it sounds. I would absolutely consider if I had a surgery that I needed to do or something, flying out of the U.S. and coming, maybe not necessarily to Panama, but another country in general.
Pauline, in Guatemala?
Very good in the city. You have a lot of U.S. trained surgeons, doctors, again, at a fraction of the price. Even here in San Diego, I often cross over to Tijuana to get dental or vet care because the prices are just a fraction. And I don't think there's anything to be concerned about. You can find the quality healthcare you need.
Travis in Mexico?
If you're on the nationalized healthcare there, the biggest complaint is it takes longer to be seen for routine checkups in healthcare. But as far as the quality of the care, no real complaints.
I want to end with this discussion, and Travis, because yours is a study and you weren't there yourself, I'm going to ask you generally for the people that you talk to, but then for Pauline and for Jim, what life lessons have you learned from this? Is there some big aha that people don't get when they don't have these adventures? Travis, and the people you talk to, is there some big aha they get, some big fantastic life thing that they wouldn't get just staying in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I did travel to a dozen of these communities and have spent a lot of time in Mexico every year. And it's the same kind of aha that I have, too. And it's this idea that there's this peace and respite from all of the crazy activity and consumerism of the United States. I mean, on one hand, you're just not familiar with it. So you're not feeling the bombardment of the billboards and the advertisements and things. So it's not to say that they're not there. They just don't kind of feel applicable to you. And two, you're kind of on an adventure. You know, you're in an unfamiliar place. And so your brain's kind of open to learning and figuring things out. And in that, there's just kind of this real break from the madness and, like I said, the consumerism of the United States. And I think even though, you know, money may be something that drives people down there, that makes them interested in leaving, I think once they get there, that kind of peaceful feeling and slower pace of life and a change in the priorities is what keeps them there.
Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think Travis kind of nailed it. I mean, you know, a lot of people in the U.S. have these preconceived notions about other countries, and in reality, it's not true. And, you know, when we moved here, I had a lot of people come up half joking, saying, oh, you're crazy. You guys are going to be living in huts in Panama, and we're not. We live in a tent. No, I'm just kidding. We're in a beautiful condo and everything. But that's not even like it. It's amazing. It's 75 degrees here every day. The mountain landscapes, they're amazing. The flowers are vivid. The people are wonderful. I mean, it's just it's almost like a wake up call that you're like, wow, you can go other places in the world and they're not scary. They're not like as bad as what you might have thought at one point in life. It's okay to leave the U.S. and check out other places in the world.
Pauline, you didn't leave the U.S. You left France initially, but you've got the last word.
Yeah, I think it's really helped me to get a bird eye view of my life as it was, my relationships with my friends. Like I can see after being away for 17 years, who do I want to see when I go back to Paris? Who do I want to spend my time, my most valuable resource with? And just the general adaptability and how the first country, the first move, yeah, it's big, it's daunting. And then the second one is just a little bit easier. And now I just grab a suitcase and off I go. And seeing how locals, for example, in Guatemala are so resourceful, so resilient, how in the U.S., it can be a big deal when people lose power for 6 hours. And in Guatemala, we've had to make do for a whole week and a whole freezer full of meat, runes, and et cetera. Stuff that breaks in the middle of the jungle and the nearest store is an hour and a half away. And you just make it work somehow. I think that's a pretty valuable life lesson. You come back a different person, more adaptable, easy going, and things that you had your nose on before that were very big deals. Suddenly you reflect back and you're like, well, that didn't matter.
This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers, they're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. As school cycled through spring break in the United States, many of you may be wondering, how do I give my kids a curriculum about money? And one guy I know who's very, very in touch with this topic and also very worried about it is our friend Benny Notchman. This is the Friday FinTech segment of our show where we learn about some new solution to a problem that people have. And today we're going to talk about kids and money. And man, do we have an app for you to talk about that. We just discovered it. It's called Jazzby, J-A-S-S-B-Y. And let's find out about it together. Say hello to our friend, Benny Notchman. And here he comes down to the basement. Our friend, Benny Notchman, is here. How are you, man?
I'm very, very good. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, sir. I'm so happy to talk to you because, as you know, parents really struggle with teaching their kids about money and with financial responsibility. I remember when my kids were young, you know, when we tell them, Betty, that we didn't have any money, they'd say, well, why don't you just put it on a card? Like that's all we got to do. So,
exactly.
So that's my issue. How did you and the team come up with Jazby? Tell me about how it all started.
You know, I have a little bit of a background in fintech, what you call in financial technology, right? So I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've been doing this for a while. So my first company was when I was in law school. So I used to practice for a few years. But then in around 2007, late 2007, I started the company before Jazby. It's called Credorax, which is it's a B2B boring story. But what it is, it's a processing bank, acquiring bank and processor. So we serve thousands of merchants all over the world. We're licensed as a bank in, I don't know, over 20 countries. And we process billions and billions of dollars in traffic. So I've been doing fintech for a while. I've been the CEO of my previous company until 2016. I'm still heavily involved, but in 2016, as I said, I decided to take a kind of a year off, brought in a professional CEO and did some consulting and did some relaxing time. And during that time, I started looking deeper into an issue that bothered me for a while. So I'm a dad of two kids. I have two boys. One is 10, one is 12. And over the years, so, you know, it's two things that kind of drove my attention. It's one is that I, at a certain age, they started asking for allowance and all of their, you know, friends were getting an allowance. So I started giving them allowance and it was difficult. You know, when they were very young, every Sunday morning, it was my job to give them $3 each. You know, half the time I didn't remember, the other half I didn't have $3 on me. Right. Like I had a 20 or a 10, but like I didn't have a three. And the other half, and I know it's three halves now, I don't know, something else happened. I was traveling or whatnot.
Yeah.
So it was never easy. And then even when I remembered and like, you know, if I skipped a week or two, I would pay them back. But then when they wanted something, most of the time it was some video game or something that they needed to download or something. They couldn't use the cash. So they would come to me with those like crumbled $1 bills that they stuffed into the piggy bank and said, hey, dad, can I use your credit card? I'm going to pay you back. The whole thing was like awkward.
Well, what's funny, by the way, not to cut you off, not only is it awkward, because that's how I grew up too, is with the crumpled cash. That's not the way you and I use money anymore. Like nobody exactly. uses it. So we're teaching kids this way of using money that we don't even use.
Exactly. So you never have cash. It's exactly that. But the second thing that really kind of, so, you know, because of my job and I ran a bank for about a decade, my kids and our, you know, our family, our neighbors, the community, we always, I used to, before Corona, I used to coach the flag football team. So we always, people know that I'm in banking and in fintech, and it always drove interesting conversations. One of the things that you pay attention to is that one, nobody talks to kids about money. They don't talk to them about money in school. There is in the vast majority of states in the United States, money and financial literacy is not in the curriculum. It's just, it's like it doesn't exist. But most households don't talk about money with the kids as well. So we don't talk about money privately, like in our own private life, but also not publicly. We don't do it at schools. And therefore, what happens is that those kids, they grow up and think about how much money and energy and intention and love and effort, right? The whole system pours into one kid from kindergarten until after college, and nobody ever talks about financial literacy. And then when they become young adults, when they go to college and they take a loan or sign up for a credit card and they don't understand what APR is or why it's not a good idea to only pay the minimum payments, we say, hey, those new generation, those kids, they don't understand, they're irresponsible, but it's not their fault. We never talk to them about it ever. So the combination of those two things, which how much it was awkward and difficult to give my kids allowance and how nobody ever talked to them about money. So in my household, we talk about money all the time because, again, that was my job.
Yeah.
But I saw how unusual that was and strange and how people like would shy away from it. This drove me to look deeper into the market. And then I noticed or I found out that an average teenager in the U.S. spends about $3,000 a year. That's a lot of money.
Wow. $3,000.
You know, if you Google it, you will see a range that's between $2,400, $2,500 to $3,000 a year.
Yeah.
normally those pieces of data are kind of backdated, like a research that was done a couple of years before. They grow year over year. I don't know what happened last year with Corona, so that might have changed a little bit. Sure. But generally speaking, over the last decade or 15 years, it's been a steady growth, like 5, 7, 10% CAGR. And yes, those are the numbers, anywhere between $2,500 to $3,000 a year and growing. Well, that's a lot of money.
Well, absolutely. And I think about also a dichotomy with two things you said to me. Number one is, on one hand, you're giving your kids $3 to trust them with. On the other hand, they're spending $3,000 probably out of dad's wallet, right? So kids are making these buying decisions. And when dad's not around, they go to college or they leave the house, they do whatever. All of a sudden, they got to make these big decisions and they've never had cash.
So no, the $3 when they were in kindergarten or first grade. So they were very, very young.
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't give the same to a five-year-old as you would give to a 14-year-old. So yes, it's most of it is from parents. I'd say 65, 70% is from parents and grandparents. And then kids have afternoon jobs. They babysit. They feed the cat or the neighbor. You know, they do all kinds of stuff. Still, the vast majority comes from the family. And this is just the money that we give them directly. So this amount of money that I've mentioned is money that they control directly. It's not influence. It's not, hey, dad, it's a good idea. I like this car over the other. If you add that on top of that, we're talking trillions, you know, in the U.S. economy. But direct money, it's about $3,000 a year. My thought was, do a few things. One, make the whole thing easier for the parents. Before we even talk about what it does for the kid, it's easier for the parents. So make it digital, make it automatic, so you can set it up and forget about it if you want. Make it safe, make it so you can control and observe and know what they're doing. And then on top of all of this is teach them something. So talk about financial literacy. And, you know, I always talk to people, you and I, before the camera went on, we joked about the gospel of Jaspi. And that's kind of how... This is kind of how I really think about it, because, you know, in this country, and this is, it's not only the U.S., by the way, this is a Western kind of hemisphere problem. This is across the world, from Germany to Japan to Israel. This is everywhere. So we do a few things. As I said, we don't talk to our kids about money, not at home, not at school. Each, by the way, I think have a different reason why, and we can talk about it if you want. But then when we once in a while talk about financial literacy, it's always in a negative, downward, condescending, criticizing way. Again, like those kids, they're dumb. They don't know what they're doing. What I'm trying to do is, again, bring the gospel of financial literacy. So let's talk about how with a series of relatively easy steps, you can do so much better. And it's not difficult. And what you need to do is just do it, talk about it, and then do it.
Yeah. Let's dive into then how the product works. So many of the founders that we talk to, Benny, it's either web-based or it's an app. How do I get my hands on Jaspi?
So it's both. It's web-based and it's an app.
Cool.
And it's a card. So here's how you do it. So in order to get started, and the service is completely free, and I'll talk about this in a second, you go to jaspi.com, and this is jaspy.com. You know, you put your email in and you click get started. Sign up takes a few minutes. By the way, a word here. This is not sign up for some video game that you give us a made up email and 123 password. This is a financial service. So there are a lot of regulations and rules around this. And when we need to be careful and follow the rules. And also you want us, or you, the user, want us to be careful because, you know, we want to be safe around money. So we need to verify people's identity. So we need to collect their full legal names and address and phone number and also social security number. Social security number is only used for identification. It's not used. There's no credit check associated. You will not be reported in any way to the credit bureaus. It's nothing like that. We are not linked to the credit bureaus. We don't share information with anybody. It's for verification. So we want to know that you are who you say you are.
And it looks like, too, when it comes to security, just looking at your stuff, you're using the same security levels that banks use, it appears.
Yes. Yes. So again, it's you have to and you want to. It's a combination of both, right?
Sure.
So
yeah,
it's how the system works. And again, you want to because you want to, yep, you want to be safe and secure. So yes, absolutely. So once you complete your sign-up, and sign-up can take 3 minutes to 5, 6 minutes. It depends on how many people you onboard, if you will, into your family. So it can be you, just you and one kid, right? Let's say for me, a dad and my older boy. Or I can bring my wife and my second son into this, and I can go maybe also bring grandma. So the more people you have, you'll have to key in a few more names and date of birth and stuff like that. Once you have approved, you can then choose between two product lines. So we have what we call the Jazbeek Preferred, which is an allowance account, which is a bank account, and the ability to deposit money and save. And the kids can see how much money they have. They can save it. They can shop at the Jazbee shop. So we offer an in-app or online shop that is completely curated by us. You can see it at shop.jazbee.com. And there, kids can buy video games, a little bit of fashion, accessories, tech, books, pet supplies, stuff that kids want. Or if you want, you can add to this a debit card. It's a MasterCard. We do it in cooperation with MasterCard. And then you get a debit card that you can use anywhere that MasterCard is accepted. So, I don't know, go buy coffee or a burger at McDonald's or wherever your favorite joint is. So you can do both. In either case, the service is free, including if you sign up for the debit card. The debit card is free. And the way you use it is that you set up allowance. And the setup allowance you can do, again, directly from your phone. And it's with a few clicks, and you can set it up to be recurring. So I don't know, let's say every Sunday morning, $30, or you can control it. You say, no, I want this, that I would initiate it. And you can say it once a month, and you can say it once a week. It's completely up to you. You can also set up chores and reward for them. You can set up academic goals and reward for them. And grandma and grandpa can do the same thing. So what we see is, you know, most of the parents do around allowance and chores and academics, and the grandparents do the fun things, the birthdays and holidays and stuff like that. So the kids would get the money immediately. It's all done real time. And then they can do one of three things. They can save. They can do good. We work with a list of 25, I think, nationwide charities that each can find the goal that speaks to him or her and do some good and donate. And the third thing they can do is spend. So they can shop in our in-house shopping mall, and they can spend using the debit card. But whatever they do, they learn, right? So I always tell people, when the kids are young, give them an allowance on a weekly basis. And why? Because when they're younger, or when they just start, give them a smaller amount of money every week, because they will make mistakes. And it's okay that they make mistakes. It's almost better than they make mistakes. But whatever the mistake would be, it's short-lived, right? Because then Sunday comes and it's all erased and it doesn't matter, and they get a fresh amount of money and it all starts over. So if they made a mistake, okay, they'll be sad for a few days and it doesn't matter. So the budgeting, even if you don't have to call it like that, you don't have to use the word, but that's what happens, right? So you tell them, hey, here's your $10. It's you for the week. Don't come talk to me about money again until next Sunday. You want to buy whatever you want to buy, it's your decision. It's also a message of empowerment. Whatever mistakes they make, it will happen. And then next Sunday, it's all going to be okay. So they learn that for this week, from Sunday to Sunday, they need to budget and think about what they want. And if they go spend it the first 10 minutes they got it, then tomorrow they won't have anything. It will happen once or twice, then they very quickly catch up. As the kids grow up a little bit, have been doing this for a while, move it to once a month. Then they need to plan for a month, and it's great. One of the things that you will see, by the way, even with younger kids, is that it, I don't know if it completely eliminates, but it reduces whining, temper tantrums, because it's a message of empowerment. Yes. Don't come to me, ask for this candy or that video game. It's all you, man. Like, you have the ability to decide. You have your money. You want a candy, go buy the candy. You want the game, go buy the game. It's all good.
And if you want the video game that's more expensive, save it. Save the money exactly. Up and get it later. That's some powerful stuff. And I love the stuff you're talking about, because it seems to me, Benny, that Jazbee's not best used alone. I think it's best used with discussions, right? I mean, it's a combination of technology and discussions with parents, but not until after they've had the opportunity to make mistakes.
Making mistakes is 100% good. It's not a bad thing. Just have them make those mistakes young and for $5 or $10, not at 19 for $50,000. And this is how we learn. It's okay. And more than anything, I think one of the biggest mistakes that we're making as a society is that we never talk about those things.
Yeah.
I always tell people the rare occasions when we do talk about this, it's always very boring, very academic, very condescending. So today, kids, we're going to talk about interest. They're not going to listen to you anyway. So you don't need to do all of those things. What you need to do is talk about allowance and talk about, you know, how you use it. And if they make a mistake, let them, and then say, you know, next week, think about doing that and that. And when you do this at 7, 8, 9-year-old, all they need is once, twice, a week or two, they'll get a hang of it very, very quickly. And you'll see then how they'll become very interested. I can tell you that my younger son, when we started, he would just watch for a while. He wouldn't even buy anything. He would just watch his balance on the app goes up and would enjoy it. And then we started talking about small things. You know, if you save money, maybe you gain a little bit of interest. So interest is your friend. If you would do the opposite one day and you borrow money because you think you don't have enough for the video game, so you want to borrow $10, then you'll need to pay interest because this is how it works. Then interest is your enemy. So with a few sentences, very casual, matter of fact, day to day, you introduce things that a lot of young adults don't know. This is not new. Probably a year or two ago, before Corona, there was a survey done. So two things I think that were interesting. So I think about 70% of millennials said that they would rather go to the dentist than to their bank. In very similar number, maybe a little bit less, 63, 65%, there were a few questions, very basic. If you borrowed, I think, $1,000 and you needed to pay 15% APR, how much money would you owe after a year? And 63, 65% couldn't do the math, right? They didn't know what an APR, what it means. Again, that's crazy, and it's our fault.
Yeah.
So start early, very easygoing. You don't need to be Warren Buffett to use it. Just give your kids a few dollars. Teach them a few basic concepts. Again, not as a lecture or not as a just as a matter of, you'll see it will come even if you don't say anything. They will come ask you.
That sounds like a tagline, by the way. Jazby, you don't want it to be Warren Buffett to use it. That's your new tagline. Parents also, I want to be clear here. You've also set it up, though, that while the child's making a mistake, you can see those all online on Jazby, right? I can monitor my child's activity. Yes. So I can, if they're really stepping in it, I can step in.
Of course. So every time they do anything, especially spend, you get real-time notification. So, of course, you can read the statements and see what happened last week, last day, last month, whatever you want, but you also get real-time notifications, right? So somebody just, so your kid, not somebody,
yeah.
Kid A just bought X for $12. The other thing that you need to remember is that we're talking about a debit card. There is no lending here. There is no credit. There is no, you can't get in trouble. So right. If you give your kid $20, there's no way for them to spend anything other than those $20. They can't spend 1 cent above.
There is no Jazby margin account.
No.
How'd you come up with the name? Where does the name come from?
So remember Seinfeld, the show about nothing? Yeah. So I was looking for a name that didn't mean anything, that you would Google it before Jazby existed. There would be, and I tried. So I had a number of names that I was thinking about.
Yeah.
And when you Google them, you get two results. It would be nothing. So I wanted Jazby because it sounded easy to say, because it sounds a tiny bit like just be,
yeah,
which I like.
Yeah.
And because it didn't have any prior meaning, so we can put our own meaning into it.
I love that. And then with everything being free, how do you guys make money, Benny?
That's a great question. So you know there's this old saying, I forgot, I should have talked about this. You know there's this old saying that if it's free, then you are the product.
Right.
Then it's not. It's not in our case. So the way we make money is because whenever you buy something using the card, the same as it is always with any card that you have, the merchant, the retailer, the business that you're buying from, they pay what's known as interchange. So that means when you go to the supermarket and you buy groceries for $100, the supermarket doesn't actually get $100. They usually get about 97. So 3% is interchange, and that goes to Visa, to MasterCard, to the issuer, to us, to
gotcha.
This is how the industry works. Again, this is not unique to Jazby in any way. This is how all the cards work for the last 70 years. So this is how we get our money from the merchants, not from the users.
Gotcha. And then a JASB account, if I am setting up my allowance, do I have an account at JASB as well as a parent? And then my money's coming from my account to their account, or is it coming from my bank? How does that work?
It comes from your bank. So we work today with literally all the banks. I think the actual percent is probably 97, but yeah, we've never actually found one that doesn't connect to us. So you can use your regular bank, whoever you work with, it doesn't matter. And then you can do two things. You can use your debit card that is associated with your bank, right? Am I making sense?
Yep.
With your regular debit card that associated with your checking account, or you can do ACH, the same way that you would pay a utility bill.
Right.
And then what happens is that, so let's talk, for example, about, I don't know, a dad. I'm always thinking about myself, right? A dad with two boys. So what you would do, I would link my own debit card from Bank of America. And then in JASB, you have a family wallet. So let's say I want to upload $100 into JASB. I would upload $100 into the family wallet. And then from there, once you have the $100, which is almost immediately, you say, okay, my older son, I want to give him $20. My younger son, I want to give him $10 so they can spend. And then it will be $70 still remains in the family wallet, $20 to my older son and $10 to the younger son. And tomorrow morning, I want to give another $10 to the younger son so I can do this with a click of the button and so on and so forth.
Gotcha. It's called JASB. We will link to it on our show notes page at stackybenjamins.com. Benny, thanks a ton for hanging out with us today and talking JASB, but even more important, just talking about financial literacy and educating our kids, because I think, like you do, man, that's so important.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Stackers, I'm your pal, Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and you know, let's turn this tale from international to something pretty much known as a U.S. pastime, drive-in movies. Did you know that the first indoor movie theater opened up on this date in 1902? And of course, that reminds me of the first time I went to a drive-in. Oh man, it was the summer of 85 and I really wanted to get some action. So me and LaFonda headed down to the local drive-in movie theater, made sure to get there really, really early and get a spot with lots of privacy. You know, for obvious reasons. I mean, you do the math. And then I slowly took her top down, and I really revved her engine, you know what I mean? People around us said to cool it because they couldn't hear the movie, but I mean, what do they expect me to do? I had an opportunity. It's become one of my fondest memory. I mean, that was the night I really grew up and became a man, you know? Okay, before I get too sentimental, let's get to today's trivia. Speaking of movie theaters, you can't fully enjoy a movie without soda and some popcorn. So how about this? In 2019, how much did the U.S. theater industry rake in from food and beverage sales? I'll be back with your answer faster than you can start up your favorite flick.
All right, we briefed the team backstage about this show. And if you're new to the Stacking Benjamins podcast, you will not know that we have a year-long competition going on between our three contributors. I thought we'd keep the sexes the same to keep it easy. So Paula, you're playing on behalf of Paula Pant from Afford Anything. So Pauline to Paula, there's not that, you know, that's not a leap. And then we have the smartest guy on the podcast, I would say, is Len Penzo, because he's the two-time returning champion. So Travis, you're the researcher, so you'll be playing on behalf of Len Penzo. And then the most adventurous person, of course, my co-host OG, and Jim, you're an adventurer. And so we thought you'd be the OG surrogate. OG is winning with 5. Len has 4. Paula has 3, which means Jim, as the champion or the surrogate, I guess, for the champion, you get the first stab at this thing.
We got this, OG. I went ahead and memorized the entire internet before in preparation for this trivia question. So we got this for sure.
That's a small flex, small flex.
Let's think about this. So this is the movie theater in general. What did they make in 2019 on food and beverages for the entire year?
I love those, by the way, while you're thinking, Jim, I love the dollar movie theaters where it cost $1 to get in and like $18.50 for a popcorn, another $8. We were at a theater yesterday and, you know, they've just opened up theaters again. So Cheryl and I went to see one, $4 for a bottle of water, $4.
Wow. Yeah. We're big on going to the drive-in, and that is exactly what would take place. You go in and it'd be, you know, like $3 a person. And then they go, all right, but if you're, they do an honor system. They go, but if you're bringing your own food and beverage, give us $20 or $30.
That's
part of how they roll.
That's crazy. So,
I mean, this is going to be far reaching. I mean, you'd think I would know this one, but I'm going to go with 1.375 billion is going to be my number.
$1.375 billion is the anchor. Travis, you're playing on behalf of Len, who finds himself down by one now. So no pressure here, big guy.
I don't have to give that long of an explanation, do I? I can just give my number.
Oh, no. It's got to be all drawn up.
Well, let's see. There's 325 million people. At $16 an average ticket, I'm going to go $6.6
billion. $6.6
billion.
And because Paula's in last place, Pauline, that means you get to go last. So what do you think? You got Travis at 6.6 billion, OG Jim at 1.375 billion.
I was thinking something like Jim's number. So I think Travis's might be a little high. So I'm going to go somewhere in the middle. I'm going to go with 3.2 billion.
$3.2 billion. Well, I'd love to tell you who is going to win this thing, but we can't do that yet. We'll be right back. Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at dell.com/welcometonow. Stackers, controlling your money on a day-to-day basis comes down to two things. Number one, great communication, either with yourself or with a partner. And by great communication, what do I mean? I mean, sitting down with your app of choice and putting together your strategy based on what you spent the week before. It's super easy. A 20-minute meeting a week, you look through your expenses, and then you plot out what are you going to do next week. And you know what? That might seem little, but the big things stem from that. And if you have an app that keeps that in front of you, that helps make it even easier. And the app Cheryl and I use is Monarch Money. We've been using it now for about a year. As you may know, I've used lots of different solutions, and this is by far the one I've stuck with the longest. It helps Cheryl and I collaborate. We can talk about our financial goals. For us, it's travel. We're also adding to our house. We have a goal in a few years to really work on our lawn as well and just make it a pretty place to live. But the travel piece, as you know, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, that's a big one. And what's cool is I can put our financial independence goals and our journey up right next to our budget, because everything at Monarch is very intuitive. It is very customizable. So what the heck is Monarch? You're sitting there wondering to yourself, aren't you? Person I just made up. Yes, let me tell you what it is. It's an all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you comprehensive view of all your accounts, your investments, your transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track your progress toward your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, Stackers, because you're a stacker, you're going to get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Benjamins. Got to have the /Benjamins to get the extended 30-day free trial so you can see that you'll like it as much as I do. How does it work? Well, it's very intuitive. It has a simple, intuitive design that makes it easy to set up, customize, and use. You can collaborate with your partner, family, or your financial advisor. What's cool is you can invite all these people to your account at no extra cost. So you can collaborate and everybody gets their own login info and everybody gets a joint view of your finances. And as I mentioned earlier, it's customizable, and best yet, it's ad-free privacy you can trust. No ads. You're not being marketed. When I had other apps that were free, I got marketed all the time. Well, not only do they not do that, they also don't sell your data to third parties. After trying out Monarch for myself and using it for about a year now, on a daily basis, I totally get why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, because you're a stacker, you're going to get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Benjamins. That's Monarch Money, MONARCHMONEY.com/Benjamins for your extended 30-day free trial. Jim, playing on behalf of OG, you are significantly lower, my friend, than the other two. They think that we're stuffing ourselves full of popcorn and peanuts more than you do.
I'm playing the low end of the spectrum here. It's going to happen. We got this.
And Travis, how comfortable you're feeling now at the top guy at 6.6? That's 3 billion higher than the next highest person.
I'm feeling pretty good. Still being in the United States, I know our consumer priorities and I know what we're capable of.
Now, if it was a Mexican theater, would it change things?
Oh, $27.
for the year. For everybody. Year. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody would bring their own in their first. <right. laughs>
And then Pauline, splitting the difference. How you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good, although $6 billion is only like $5 an American. So we might be way off still.
We're about to see. Pauline's got $3.2 billion. All right, Doug, what's our answer?
Hey, trivia fans, I am your very disappointed host, Joe's Mom's Neighbor, Doug. Texts have been rolling in over the last few minutes talking about how this is a family show and why would I share such a racy story. Racy? Well, first off, get your minds out of the gutter, people. This is not at all a sultry tale. I said I wanted to get some action, so I went to watch Tron, like the best action movie of all time. And I went with my car that I named La Fonda, because who doesn't name their first car, especially after Napoleon Dynamite? I wanted privacy. You know me, I got a tender heart. I didn't know what that movie would bring. There could be some like soft, teary parts in there. And if I got emotional, I should be in the privacy of my own car. And then I took the top down because it was a convertible. That's not hard to figure out. And I had to rev La Fonda's engine every few minutes because the damn thing wouldn't start and I didn't want to get stranded. That's it. Nothing more. I don't know how you did the math you did to get where you got. Hope you all feel disgusted with yourselves. I sure know I am. Blech. Think you've had enough. So let's get back to today's trivia and just clean this all up a little bit, okay? The question was, in 2019, how much did the U.S. theater industry rake in from food and beverage sales? If you guessed $5.7 billion, you'd be right. Guessing that number is going to be just a smidge lower for 2020. Anyway, that reminds me, I could really use some popcorn right about now. See ya.
Oh.
Travis
That's
goes.
A lot of popcorn.
That is a ton of popcorn. Well, I don't know, man. It's like $12 a tub, Pauline. That's still not really that much sure. Popcorn.
Is there any
I'm still thinking popcorn? Panamanian prices.
Yeah.
Yes, there is no Price is Right rule, Travis, to answer your question. You are the winner, my friend. Congratulations.
All right. Well, that made being a guest worth it.
that was it. And I'm sure you'll get a big pat on the back from Mr. Penzo, too, to defend his honor. So nice job. Hey, let's take out the magnifying glass here and help somebody else do better with their money. Today's hotline call comes to us courtesy of MagnifyMoney.com. Jim, when you go to StackingBenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney, you know what happens?
Tell me, Joe.
Nice job. you find those financial products you use every day are nowhere near the best in class if you're just at your brick and mortar bank. Over 92% of the checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs, reward cards, consolidation loans, all the banking products you use every day, all ranked head to head, 92% of them available online at Magnify Money. Go to stackybenjamins.com/Magnify Money for more. And today, we're going to help Jake with his money. Say hi, Jake.
Hey, Joe and OG and whoever else happens to be there today. It's Jake here. I'm a high school business teacher, and my question is, what is the best way to send stocks as a gift? With graduation coming up, I'm sure I'll have a few invites, and instead of giving my students cash, I would really like to give them some sort of stock. I was thinking some sort of ETF or something like that. And I guess follow-up question, is it possible to send a fractional share? The specific ones that I'm looking at are trading at $350. And as a high school teacher, I don't think I could afford that for all of my students. To the other listener of the show, I asked this question. You better get thinking of one for the next one. Thanks. Bye.
No pressure on the other listener. Now, Jake asked his question. Thanks a ton, Jake. This was the closest one I could get to your expertise, guys, because living abroad, I also wonder about mail service. I wonder about actually getting gifts abroad. And then I guess I'll ask you also if you have an answer to Jake's question, but no pressure there. Travis, the boomers in Mexico have trouble getting gifts or things from the U.S.?
I don't know. I don't have a like a really good answer to this. What I can tell you actually is that I own an online pillow company. And so I do know that when customers try and get our pillows into Mexico, there can sometimes be challenges at the border, making sure that stuff is like is listed as personal use stuff instead of business stuff. So I know that businesses sometimes have trouble sending larger, more expensive items down because of the risk of it looking like you're trying to scoot the tariff system or whatever they have in place there. But by and large, though, you can get most of the things that you want from the United States down in Mexico, especially with the explosion of Walmart and Costco and stores like that. So,
is your pillow company slightly less controversial than the only other one I know?
It's slightly less controversial.
Well, tell us what it is.
As I say, we only want a sleep revolution. That's all we want.
Tell us the name of your company, if you don't mind.
Queen Anne Pillow Company, QueenAnnePillow.com.
Fantastic.
Thank you. I assume I'll have to pay for that.
Yeah, we'll get Westwood One's reps here to
I see the invoice just hit my inbox.
Yeah, to swoop in right now. Yes, that's where they get you. They say, come on for free, then they have you advertise stuff. Sure. Pauline, Travis, any advice for him about shares? Have you ever sent shares to a friend, relative, shares of stock?
I haven't sent shares, but I can tell you, I mean, just with regard to Mexico, currency is a really interesting thing to look at because of the way, you know, the volatility of the peso sometimes is as volatile as my Bitcoin. But, you know, people are really looking at when do I use pesos to buy something versus when do I bring in more dollars to buy something. So I may encourage him to look at currency and the peso and timing around acquiring that.
That's cool. Pauline, getting mail in Guatemala, any problems there?
Yes, it's impossible. So the postal service went bankrupt about, I would say, 7 years ago. And as a result, there's nothing. And I never had a mailbox because my house was too remote anyway. But now you have companies in the US, there are mailbox addresses where you can send your Amazon purchase. And then for about $5 a pound, they will mail it to you in Guatemala, to a shopping center or one of their distribution hubs, and you can go pick it up there. So it's much faster than sending your own parcel because it takes the evening flight from Miami and then the next morning it's in Guatemala. That's pretty convenient.
How close was your closest mailbox?
A couple of hours away.
Okay.
So it's things that I don't find there, say good bed sheets for my guest house that I would have to bring. But I usually travel enough to just bring stuff in my suitcase. And then to send stuff to family, I use Amazon in France to send a present to a friend, for example. That works much better when you use the local stuff than trying to ship something from Guatemala and hope it arrives.
Did you get good pillows down there?
Not really.
I could maybe hook you up. I've got a friend. And then Jake's particular question, Pauline, what do you think about that? Fractional shares or sending gifts of stock?
I've seen a couple of websites offer shares as a gift, but I'm not sure whether the kids, if they're minors, are they allowed to receive a share from a teacher? And if they'd have to open their own brokerage, it might be a little bit complicated, but that's an awesome gift to teach the kids to save, invest, and the value of an asset that increases in value.
Jim, mail in Panama?
Mail in Panama? No.
You don't?
No, they... no mail. Well, like Pauline said, like one of our biggest eye openers here is they don't even have addresses here in Panama. You can get a PO box if you want to go to the postal service, but usually like mail takes like a month to get there if it gets there, and it's kind of crazy. But yeah, so we also have similar to what Pauline was saying. I mean, you can send things to like an intermediary in Miami, and then they'll ship it to Panama. We actually have like a mailboxes, et cetera, here that we can pick stuff up at. But it can get expensive. So usually it's when you head back to the U.S., you stack up on your suitcase, give people gifts then or whatever. But just to give you an example, Joe, like I needed to get some legal documents signed and sent out to a company in the U.S. a couple months ago. And I wanted it to go as fast as possible. And even mailboxes, et cetera, said the best they could do was 5 to 7 business days at a cost of $45 for an envelope. And
wow.
I mean, it is what it is. But yeah, so it's not something we do very often just for that reason.
Yeah, that's crazy. But you do have the same Amazon type system, go to a box and pick it up?
No, there's not one of those. But like you can send things. There's small little storefronts here.
Gotcha.
And so they'll issue you like a fake address in Miami, which is basically almost like a warehouse in Miami. And so Amazon will ship your product to this Miami warehouse with your little address. And then eventually it shows up about a little less than a week later in Boquete here.
Someday. That's crazy. And then any advice for Jake in particular on his stock?
You know, Pauline brought up a good point about the age. I'm not sure with a minor if that's a big deal, but I did see on one website, I just Googled a couple things here real quick, but a friend of ours, you probably know him, Dough Roller, he actually has an article talking about 7 ways to gift stocks. And one of them is sending out fractional shares via a company. I don't know if you want me to say the name of it.
No, go ahead. That's great.
I don't know how reputable it is, but Spark Gift, SparkGift, looks like that's something. It says you could buy it for as little as $20 with a fee of $2.95. So plus a little fee on the cost of the security, but that's not too bad.
Yeah, we had the founder of SparkGift on the show talking about that. They got eaten up by Stockpile, which to my mind, Jake, is really the easiest one that I know. And it solves Pauline's problem immediately, which is the problem of whether they're a miner or not. So what happens is you give them the stock, they end up getting the gift, but they don't actually get the stock until they redeem it. And so then they sit down with a parent who helps them open the account, and it's opened however it's best for them. So if you ever get stock from Stockpile, you want to redeem it right away. Cause I gave my nephews the gift and my brother didn't do anything with it. And then I found out that, actually take that back. It was my brother. It was a family friend, but anyway, his dad didn't do anything with it. And, like a year later realized he'd never opened up the account, and it was in Tesla, and it had gone straight up the entire year. And even though it was a fractional share, I mean, I just gave him $50 a Tesla. It would have been worth a lot more. But because he didn't claim it, that's the problem. So, but yeah, Stockpile is the only company, Jake, that I know of. But I'll also link to Rob's piece. It probably is at least 2 years old, though. But we'll go ahead and link to it because Rob's one of the smartest guys I know. Rob Berger over at Dough Roller. Good stuff.
How come you didn't mention us as the smartest people you know?
You guys, I mean, a present company accepted. Yes. Fourth smartest person I know. Right. All right. Speaking of that, before I get myself in more trouble, let's get the hell out of here. That's going to do it for today. Let's talk about what's going on where you guys work and with the stuff that you're working on. Pauline, what are you doing over at Reach Financial Independence right now as we speak?
Not much, because I recently got my work permit, and up until then, the IRS was considering blog writing as illegal. So I kind of took a little hiatus to stay in compliance and not get kicked out of the country.
Probably a good safety tip, yeah.
Yeah, so my volunteering with the Relief Society has been where I've been dedicating my time, and I'm studying to become a CFP.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I assume then that we will be seeing a lot more than, I'm guessing by the way you're talking, there's going to be new stuff coming at Reach Financial Independence?
Hopefully. I'm thinking of doing consulting eventually and financial counseling, which I've come to appreciate a lot, the offline work rather than being stuck with my screen all day. So maybe, maybe not. We'll see. The weather is pretty nice and I like the beach.
You're in San Diego. Just holy cow. Yeah. It's not, I would not want to be staring at a screen in San Diego. Likewise, in Panama, Jim, what's going on at Route to Retire, my friend?
Well, let's start with this. I mean, next week we're going ziplining through the jungle, and then we're super excited to have my in-laws visiting us next month for a couple of weeks. They'll be our first visitors here. So we're actually counting down the days until they get here. I think that's not something a lot of people say about their in-laws, but we're very excited for them to be here. And yeah, other than that, still having fun writing on Route to Retire. I write about personal finance, early retirement, and traveling. And then, of course, we're busy enjoying everything Boquete Panama has to offer.
Just your story about navigating COVID was I don't know if horrifying is the right word.
Insane.
Insane. Yeah. Everybody's
but it worked out.
Everybody's got to check that out, especially as, yeah, just trying to, you're one of the people trying to get out of the country. Well, a lot of people trying to get out of the country, but you're trying to get out and get into Panama.
They went into complete lockdown here, and we could not even leave our condo, with a couple exceptions, like to go to a grocery store on, like, you'd be allotted like a certain hour of certain days to run to the grocery store. But, you know, not bad for a little bit, but after a couple months with a 10-year-old in the condo with you, it starts to get a little old.
I can't imagine. I love board games, but there's just not enough board games to keep me busy. Travis, the book is called The Fun Side of the Wall, Baby Boomer Retirement in Mexico. I'm assuming available everywhere?
As far as I know, yeah. But my preference would be to check it out on Amazon or go to funsidebook.com. And we've got some other data that didn't end up in the book there if you'd like to look at some other infographics.
What was the most surprising thing you found while writing the book?
The most surprising thing I found while writing the book is how much more likely single women are to move to Mexico on their own than married couples or single men. I found this really amazing group of adventurous baby boomer women who were ready for a next chapter in their life and just really bucked conventional wisdom on, you know, doing adventurous things on their own. And they were a ton of fun to meet and interview and hang out with.
That's awesome. We will link to not only the book, but also to Jim and Pauline's sites on our show notes page at stackybenjamins.com. Guys, thanks a ton for being part of this special episode. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Joe. That was fun.
All right, Doug, what should we have learned on today's show?
So what should we have learned today? First, take a lesson from our roundtable discussion. Retiring abroad is a much more feasible option than you'd think and can help your money to go further if you do some research. Second, take a lesson from our Friday FinTech segment. Technology can help you have better conversations with your kids about money and help them learn about modern money management.
But the big lesson, don't talk in non-specific terms with this audience. You all have dirty, dirty minds.
To learn more about our guests and for more resources, you can head to our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. Thanks to Jim White for joining us. You'll find Jim in Panama. So, you know, just like head down there and walk around a little while. You probably spot him. But also, probably easier to just go to routetoretire.com. You'll find Travis Luther's book, The Fun Side of the Wall, wherever books are sold, and we'll share a link at our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. Pauline Paquin's blog is reachfinancialindependence.com. You'll see her adventures in Guatemala all over her site. Thanks also to Benny Natchman from Jaspi for joining us. Head to jaspi.com, that's spelled JASSBY.com, to check it out if you're looking for a resource to help teach your kids about money. This show is created by Joe Salcihi, produced by Karen Rapine, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I'm wondering if KY jelly is actually made in Kentucky. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remunerations. That's a big word. There's no way you take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. And before making any financial decisions, consult with a real financial advisor.
Welcome to the After Show. This is the part of the show that doesn't exist. For those of you that are new here, we don't talk about the After Show. We have had people we've said that to before. They've talked about it anyway, so we made an exception. You could talk about dessert online, but you can't talk about the After Show. I have a story that I've talked about a lot where I insisted in the most annoyingly American way that I wanted port. And the dude in France, by the way, Pauline, was speaking to me in French. My daughter speaks French, mm-hmm. and I won't tell you the whole story, but he kept telling me over and over, we don't serve port. And I kept insisting that I wanted port in English. And the guy finally actually went to a store next door and bought me some damn port to shut me up. And that's what my daughter said. That's what my daughter told me. She goes, I said, I think he went next door to buy some. And Autumn said, that's exactly what he did, Dad. I said, what the hell are you talking about? And Autumn said, here's a conversation you were having. I'd like some port. We don't have any port. Porto, yeah, sweet wine. We don't serve. We don't serve that, sir. Port, Portugal, port. We don't have any. And anyway, I think that guy hated me, but I had no idea what he was talking about. So I'm wondering if in your trips abroad, if you guys have had any similar things happen. Travis, I would guess you may have a story.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in my first solo trip to Mexico, you know, all by myself. I was very proud of myself. I hacked out a bunch of Spanish. I got around just fine. And I went to this restaurant, this outdoor patio restaurant, and I'm a vegetarian. And so, you know, I have to always negotiate the menu, which is kind of hard. Those are the things you don't really go over in Spanish class. And so I thought, I'm doing a great job. I told the guy I'm a vegetarian. I saw that they had like this mushroom taco, this poblano taco, and then also like this fajita veggie taco. And I told him what I thought I told him was, I want the taco platter, but can I just get one of each of the veggie tacos instead of having to get, you know, three of one kind? And he kind of like looked at me funny. And I said, I kept telling him I'm vegetarian. And then I also wanted to get a side of rice and beans for each one too. And so he finally nods and he leaves and he comes back and he puts three platters, like three full meals down in front. That's three sides of rice, three sides of beans. So apparently I wanted one of every. What he was trying to tell me was that was too much food. And I was trying to tell him he didn't understand what I was saying. So anyway, suffice to say, I had a couple boxes on to take home with me.
This American can eat.
That's right.
Yes. Pauline, in your travels, any big miscommunication?
Yeah, I had liver for breakfast because the word for liver in Arabic is very close to butter. So I thought I was being served something buttery and delicious, like a croissant. And I was staying with the family and I cannot waste food. So that was a bit hard to swallow, literally.
You're like, ooh, butter, ooh, livery. Sounds great for me. Jim, how about you, man?
I was thinking about it. My wife is going to kill me because I actually had a great story and I can't remember the punchline. We were in Jamaica and we were in a limo. It was the same cost as a cab to go somewhere. And I can't remember what I had said, but I had misunderstood completely what this guy was saying. And Joe, I'm just blowing the whole thing because I can't remember it. It was the funniest thing and I just ruined everything.
You had to be there. Yeah, great story, Jim. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm great with those. Great at stories.
Well, I hope you got a lot out of today's episode. But one thing that we talked about a little bit today, but we talk about a lot, is you got to have good partners on your team, Stackers. And you know what? Navy Federal Credit Union could be that partner, because becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you earn more and save more. And aren't those two of the big tenets, right? Have a debt strategy, earn more, save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. I think that's the coolest certificate. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project? Maybe you want to consolidate debt. Well, as you're putting your plan together, you want to also have a debt strategy, right? And you could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed rate home equity loan with zero closing cost, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Don't get in over your head with debt. Make sure you have a great strategy and then take out debt as you need it. And Navy Federal's options certainly give you the flexibility to help you make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, equal housing lender, membership required, terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval.